Well, welcome to 5 o'clock and round two of your after workday entertainment for the day. My name again is Katie Benjamin. I am a PhD student, that's Doctor of Theology student, out at Duke Divinity School all the way in Durham, North Carolina. It's a very good place to be. I've been enjoying myself there for the last 5 years, which is exactly the mark of when I was last at Holden. I went from Holden to there and haven't left since until a few days ago. Anyway, very much enjoying myself. It's a good place to study, and just a little bit about that so you can sort of know what you're getting into and who is presenting information to you today. Because of where I am in a divinity school and the sort of students we get, most of them are pastors and all of them are interested in serving the church in some capacity, that really controls the way I study and the way I teach and present information in a way that I hope will be helpful to you as well. I've had a friend who describes the divinity school as a perfect hypostatic union. It is completely church and completely academy. It is a unity of both of those things. And what it means for somebody who studies history and teaches history is that we study history as largely the history of doctrine and the history of heretics. So if you take an early church class at a place like Duke Divinity School, you get a sense of how the church's doctrine and creedal statements really develop. And who helps develop them by, espousing an alternative opinion. Heretics are really good in that way. They help you to clarify your doctrine. They do that. They also teach you patience, which is one of the great things that I hope students who are going to be pastors especially take from a history class is to how to really sit with an alternative point of view long enough to understand where that person is coming from and what drives them and what, in a lot of cases, really scares them. Because heresy just comes from the Greek word for choice. This is somebody who has chosen one aspect, usually a right aspect, of Christian doctrine and allowed it to get so big that it excludes other things, other truths that also fall under the umbrella of Orthodox Christianity. And if you've ever heard anybody say that it's really difficult to preach a sermon and not speak heresy, it's because a good sermon is focused, and focus to the exclusion of other things can get you to exactly that place. Another thing that I will say about why I enjoy teaching history is that in the church, and particularly in America, we suffer from a sort of condition that has been called chronocentrism. If you've heard of ethnocentrism, that's sort of the idea that we as a people can't necessarily learn from other people, other cultures. We've sort of got it figured out, and they do their thing, and that's clever and interesting, but it's theirs, and we can't really learn from it. Chronocentrism is the idea that we're always progressing. We're always getting better sort of throughout history. We're getting more tolerant and more clever and more capable of doing things. And so we're not necessarily able to learn from, other people, in this case, people who came before. And I like letting the tradition surprise us rather than just sort of staying with that chronocentric point of view. Anyway, that's who I am. And that's a little bit of what characterizes, again, how I do my studying and how I present information. So without further ado, to the topic for today, which is sort of how the first Christians interacted with the secular order in which they found themselves, namely the Roman Empire. The first thing I've put on your handout is actually a couple of scripture passages that begin to give us a sense that it wasn't all rosy, it certainly wasn't all perfect. We have a sense, and you don't necessarily have to look these up, but if you do have a Bible, you're welcome to. We have a sense that the Gospel of Mark is written to a persecuted community because Jesus says some very explicit things in there. We know from the Gospel of John that Jesus said lots of things. John says that if all of the things that Christ said were written down, the whole world could not contain the books. So it's interesting that Mark focuses on a few of these really particular things that really seem to speak to a community undergoing persecution, saying things like the Son of Man must himself undergo suffering, and that his followers must take up his cross and follow him, and that those who want to save their lives will ultimately lose them, but losing their lives will find them. And when they go, of course, on a day trip to see the temple, Jesus says that all of this will be pulled down. Not one stone will be left on another. You yourselves, talking to his disciples, will be brought to trial. But don't worry about what you're going to say, because the Holy Spirit will give you the words. I mean, these are some very, very particular things that you can imagine would speak to people who are directly facing that sort of persecution. And then, of course, Jesus himself in the Gospel of Mark isn't given too many words to say. We get a very human picture of his suffering when he's brought to trial. He kind of limits his answers to, "I am who you say I am," or "you say so." And then his suffering on the cross is a very human suffering. So anyway, so that's the Gospel of Mark. 1 Peter 4, actually, if somebody does have a Bible, this would be one that would be worth looking at together. But if nobody says, I can read it. That's all right. That's okay.
I have it.
Oh, great. Actually, if you can start at verse 12 then and read on to verse 19.
What chapter? Can't find 19. 19, okay. Sorry.
So start at verse 12. Thanks.
Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that is taking place among you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you are sharing Christ's suffering, so that you may also be glad and shout for joy when his glory is revealed. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory, which is the Spirit of God, is resting on you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, a criminal, or even as a mischief maker. Yet if any of you suffers as a Christian, do not consider it a disgrace, but glorify God because you bear this name. For the time has come for judgment to begin with the household of God. If it begins with us, what will be the end for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is hard for the righteous to be saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinners? Therefore, let those suffering in accordance with God's will entrust themselves to a faithful Creator while continuing to do good.
Thank you. So do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal. Suffering comes up, the word, a number of times in this passage. And the time has come for judgment. That's another example of a passage that would surely speak to folks who are undergoing some sort of persecution, right? And then finally, Revelation 13, which is a very fun chapter of a very fun book where we're introduced to the beast. And then there's a second beast, and there are heads and there are horns, and they all have very, very obscure meanings. But the last verse of that chapter is probably the most famous. But I'll give you the last two verses, actually, so that no one, the last three verses. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark that is the name of the beast or the number of its name. And this calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person. Its number is 666. Lots of ink has been spilled trying to convince readers or some audience or whatever that, I have wisdom, I have the answer. It is this person, or it is this regime, or it is this age, and we can name it. and fix the number 666 to it. If you have a study Bible in front of you or as part of your regular devotions, you might have a note that says there are other manuscripts that give this number as 616. So there is some variation there. But I've set you up on your handout, actually, with the beginnings of practicing your own wisdom and deciding for yourself what 666 or 616 could mean, just to give you a sort of example of what this might be pointing to, how this text, too, could be addressing a persecuted community. What you've got in front of you is how to count in Hebrew. I've written out the Hebrew alphabet for you from left to right, which, if you know anything about Hebrew, is exactly not how any Hebrew writer or reader would. But it's easier for me to look at this way, so I hope it's a little bit easier for you to look at. And below each letter, the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, you've got numbers, and you can see it goes up digits 1 through 10, and then it starts, instead of going to 11, it goes to 20. Goes by tens for a while, and then once you get to 100, you go to 200. And the question of how you get above 400 is that there are certain letters that are written differently if they fall at the end of a word. So those give you another five letters, those variations, which stand for additional values. But these are all the ones we need if we suspect, as many have, that the person being indicated by the number 666 or 616 is the Emperor Nero, about whom we're going to talk a little bit in a minute, a little bit further. Because if you spell out his name in Hebrew, if you get Nero Caesar, which I've done for you again below, and then you match those letters to their values, add them up, and you'll get the number 616. The variation, actually, I mean, the difference of 50 between 616 and 666 can be accounted for whether you use a terminative N on the word Nero, as you would if you were writing it in Greek, but as you would not if you were writing it in Hebrew. So both of those numbers are extant in really old manuscripts, which makes it very hard to tell which one would have been meant by the original author of Revelation. But it seems to me that they could sort of both have come up together, and one is just an attempt to correct the Greek of the other. But anyway, add them up, and that is what you get. So like I said, this has also been, you just pick different letters and try different combinations and see what you get. People have tried to point to any number of world leaders. I think Nero is a pretty good one. Not just for matching, but because another thing we learn from Revelation 13 is that this crazy beast thing has received a fatal wound, but seems to have recovered from it. Nero committed suicide in 68, year 68 of the Common Era, or Anno Domini, depending on how you like to mark history. And there were lots of legends that he was coming back, the Nero Redivivus legends. So it's a good indication that he might be the beast that's indicated in Revelation 13, which again sort of goes back to raise the question of, you know, the people who are writing the scripture and this first generation that's reading the books that we now call the New Testament undergoing this sort of persecution. So now that I've made that case, let's turn back actually to Acts chapter 18. Carol, since you've got a Bible, if you wouldn't mind, I get tired of the sound of my own voice pretty easily. But if you can find Acts 18 and read for us, starting at verse 12, you just give us that paragraph there through to verse 17, just to sort of raise the question of, here we're going to get a picture of Christians interacting with a Roman official, and get an idea of what that would have been like in the generation in which Acts takes place. You got it? Go for it.
But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. They said, "This man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law." Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, I would be justified in accepting the complaint of you Jews. But since it's a matter of questions about words and names in your own law, see to it yourselves. I do not wish to be a judge of these matters. And he dismissed them from the tribunal. Then all of them seized Sosthenes, the official of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of these things.
Thank you. Gallio paid no attention to any of these things. This is a different picture. I mean, we've seen a couple of passages that indicate that, you know, Christians are undergoing suffering and persecution, and we can identify that that was probably from the secular order in which we spoke of them, namely the Roman and emperor, the Roman Empire and emperors such as Nero. But here we've got a Roman official who actually backs off and says, this is not, this religious dispute is something that's taking place between you Jews, and you wouldn't have been using the word Christians yet, but it's taking place, you know, on a plane that, as a Roman official, he doesn't want to deal with. This is not a question of crime or serious villainy, in the NRSV translation. So here, you know, you've got sort of this hands-off approach. And the question is, if that's, you know, if that's how things start, how do we sort of get to 1 Peter 4 and a fiery ordeal? How do we get from a religious dispute that the Romans don't want to deal with into something that's worth sticking a Christian in a Colosseum covered with skins of wild beasts to be torn apart and things like that? So, to answer that question, I want to think with you guys for a second about how the Romans sort of understood religion generally before we get to sort of how they're interacting with the Christians. How did they understand religion generally? And the word that's really going to help us sort this out in Latin is pietas, which you can probably guess is where we get the English word piety. And it basically means respect. What it means specifically is having respect for the customs of one's ancestors. I put the Latin for that on your handout because I'm a historian and that's what we do. So those are the mos maiorum, the sort of practices and customs of one's ancestors. We think of innovation as a good thing, having the newest iPhone and the new, well, you know, we might not necessarily apply in a place like this, but, you know, sort of in America generally, and Western culture generally, we love innovation. We want the newest gadgets, we want, you know, the latest information. We're going to be trendy and follow blogs to get our news and things like that. Completely the opposite under the Roman Empire. Innovation is bad. What you really want is to continue to practice the same things that generations previous to you practiced that have already made Rome great, so that Rome can continue to be great. That is what we want. Status quo maintained all the way. So it's having this respect, but it's also showing this respect. So it is tied into a religious aspect in as much as you want to visit the temples, you want to turn out for the festivals and for the circuses and the games and things, you know, these celebrations, and you want to offer sacrifices and incense once in a while to show that you, in fact, honor the gods, the Roman pantheon, the people who, according to the legends of the founding of Rome, chose the earlier generations, your ancestors, that then in turn made Rome great by becoming senators and emperors and things like that. So that's pietas. That's how Romans practice sort of their own religion. It's respect for the customs of the generations that came before. That's their attitude towards their own religion. Now here's the question is, what is their attitude towards other religions? Because Rome at this point, I mean, we're talking, you know, from England in the north to parts of Africa in the south, you know, Spain all the way to Asia. It's huge, and there are a lot of people by this time that they've conquered with a lot of different cultures and a lot of different religious practices. So the question is, how do they deal with these varieties of religious practices? How do they encounter new cultures that have different temples and different gods that aren't recognized in Rome itself? And what I'd like to suggest is that their attitude towards these other traditions and other cultures was one of pragmatic toleration. And there are two reasons for this. One is, with an empire that vast, this is completely practical and political. You don't want to, you know, have rebellion every other week, because that's going to interrupt you. There's a reason you conquered the folks over in Egypt. It's because they grow a lot of grain, and you want that grain to make it to the capital. So you don't want the Egyptians to be in rebellion, and a good way to put people in rebellion is to close their temples down around them. I mean, when you sort of take a culture from a people, they're going to fight back in a way that, you know, if you just show up and say, we're in charge now, and build some roads and leave some soldiers to maintain the peace, they might actually think, well, living our lives day to day kind of the same way we were, maybe this new order is okay, because it's not really interfering. So that's one of the reasons to sort of tolerate other religions, as the Romans saw it. It's just, you know, to not encourage people to rebel, basically, because rebellion gets old. But the other reason is sort of hedging one's bets. The Romans knew they had the best gods. They knew that, you know, how they had it worked out, how to propitiate their gods. But, you know, Rome is here. Alexandria is over there. Asia is, you know, even further afield, and maybe the Roman gods don't have sort of plenary authority over all of these places. So the idea was other gods may in fact exist. You know, the Romans weren't exclusive in that way. They weren't jealous for their pantheon. They were eager to build their temples and have these other cultures that they've conquered show their new pietas by offering incense and recognizing the Roman authority in the form of the Roman gods. But they were also interested in maintaining these temples further afield so that they could also keep not only the population under control, but their gods, who they were happy to admit might exist and might have power, they wanted to keep those gods on their side. So that is kind of the general attitude Romans had toward other religions. And there was an exception, namely the Druids, in you know, what is now called England, because they were offering human sacrifices, so that had to stop. But what? Right. And in fact, this is something Augustine has written about in the City of God. He says, he makes the case that the Roman Empire lasts as long as it does and is sort of granted the purview of power that it is by God because it's restraining the wickedness of so many other cultures. They're generally decent, virtuous folk. So then the question, and this is really the question that I want to deal with today, is, well, what then became the problem with Christianity? How do we sort of get from this account that we see in Acts chapter 18, Gallio the proconsul being totally hands-off and fine with what the Christians are doing? I mean, okay, you're getting in an argument. Have your argument privately. I'm not actually going to rule, and I'm certainly not going to have anybody put in prison. How do we get from there to something far more sinister, Christians in the Colosseum? And once we get there, is that sort of the policy from here on out, systematically and, sort of top down throughout the empire, everybody hates the Christians all of a sudden and that policy endures, or is it a sort of isolated thing? I mean, these are sort of the questions that we're asking ourselves. So, turning back to our dear friend Nero, who may or may not be indicated in that chapter that we looked at in Revelation, I put a couple of passages on the back of your handout. And the first one is an account from a historian named Tacitus of the Great Fire of Rome. It took place in 64 AD and it began on the 18th of June. It burned for 5 days. It destroyed most of the city. Probably about 3/4 of the city was affected, if not out and out leveled, by this. And the problem, the real problem was Nero wasn't just sort of feared and hated by the Christians, although you'll see in Tacitus' account how he came to be so. He wasn't particularly loved by anybody. There were rumors that he was mad. like insane, that he was, you know, violent in certain ways, and he was certainly more concerned with his own power and his own comfort and his own luxury rather than, you know, the comfort or safety of his subjects. So in fact, when this fire started, and by all accounts, we're pretty sure it was an accident because the place where it started was a warehouse for a place that sold lamps, and lamps work by being able to burn stuff. So there's a ton of oil in a warehouse, and it caught fire, and you can sort of imagine the logical conclusion of that.
Does it, how do you know that? Does it say that somewhere?
Yeah, no, like other places in Tacitus' account is,
it's, I mean, he meant lamp warehouse.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, a lamp warehouse is roughly where they think the fire started. And Tacitus doesn't necessarily blame Nero for it. He's not Nero's biggest fan, but he is pretty fair in terms, just one historian to another. I think Tacitus is okay. I don't know what he's saying about me, but. But what he does record for us, it's really interesting, is that because Nero sort of had this reputation, there's a rumor that Nero started the fire. And there's also a rumor, if you've ever heard of Nero fiddling while Rome burned, it's this idea that Nero was kind of celebrating because what he wanted was sort of a new place to build a playground of some sort for himself, and Rome was in the way. So he got rid of it in this clever way, you know, torch it and collect the insurance and then build something more fun. But anyway, again, tired of the sound of my own voice, if somebody could read from Tacitus here, just to sort of give us an idea of what happened when Rome started burning. And I may interrupt you every now and then just to make a comment, but a volunteer with a nice reading voice, please.
But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor and the propitiation of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration was the result of an order. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment again, broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular.
Yeah.
Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired.
So that's a nice bedtime story. Couple of things here. I mean, this is an absolutely famous text paragraph. You can find it all over the place on the internet because it's one of those really early, really not New Testament accounts that we have of the early Christians. Sort of a mention of this strange new religion that was on the rise in the first and second century. Of the Common Era. Tacitus is writing towards the end of his life. We think, you know, probably around 115, he might have finished this. So a generation or so later than when these events took place. But he nevertheless says some really interesting things. Let me draw your attention to that fourth line down from the top. A class hated for their abominations. Let's just sort of imagine together. I mean, he doesn't go into specifics here, but he does later on. What sort of abominations might be associated with Christians? I mean, just think for a second that you're not yourself a practicing Christian. You've only just got hearsay to go on. What are some of the things you might know about Christianity that make you say, what?
They may be unlikely to pay taxes.
Right. So a little bit of healthy civil unrest and disobedience, sure, because there's a great story there about, Jesus says,
drink blood.
All right, now we're getting somewhere. Okay, so maybe some healthy civil disobedience, but yeah, the drinking blood thing is a little difficult to get beyond. Eating flesh and drinking blood. Okay, anything, what do Christians call one another?
Brothers and sisters.
Incest. And does anybody know? How do they greet one another?
The holy kiss.
Oh my goodness. Brothers and sisters kissing. Exactly. When do Christians meet in this generation?
After dark.
They follow the Jewish custom, at least for a while, of meeting in the evenings. So they're getting together in the evenings, brothers and sisters, greeting each other with a kiss. And what happens after that? What sort of event are they holding? Has anybody run across the name for this? What a Christians in that generation would have called their worship service? It's a love feast.
Oh.
An agape feast. Yeah, the word agape gets fixed to that, but if you're not sort of, and of course love, you know, lots of different words for it, and they're all very specific, but if we're not careful, an agape feast with brothers and sisters, and they're kissing, and it's at night, and then they have blood and flesh on the table, apparently. You can sort of get a sense of what these abominations and rumors might have consisted of. Good. Okay, so these are the rumors that are flying around, and you can sort of imagine what's going through Tacitus' mind as a good Roman, rational person about these crazy folk. Another little thing about two lines down in the middle, two lines below from where we were, so the sixth line, the words, a most mischievous superstition. So not a lot of respect for this new thing, because by this time Tacitus has recognized it as very new. It's not just an interreligious dispute between a bunch of Jews, but it's a bunch of Jews who, side note, are respected by the Romans because they're weird, but they're old. They have a lot of the same problems that Christians have of, wanting to sort of adhere to their own practices and customs and not adopt a lot of Roman practices and customs. But the Jews are old, and their God is really old, and they've been established for a long time, and that sort of strikes a chord with a people that practice this pragmatic toleration. So there are a couple of conflicts and famous battles that come up, and I think if you're interested in them, you should totally ask Gene, because I hear he's interested in them. But for the most part, the Romans are going to leave the Jews alone. On the other hand, you've got this new sect of Jews who have basically appeared to convert away from Judaism. Innovation. We hate that. So they've abandoned their own mos maiorum, the practices of their ancestors, and done something new. That's kind of what's behind this idea of the mischievous superstition. That the abandonment of their own gods, but also the fact that, like the Jews who they've sort of abandoned, they want to believe in their God to the exclusion of the Roman pantheon. So a superstition that seems to the Romans like something like atheism, because they're not willing to recognize these other gods. And how silly is that? It's not hard. You can keep your God, just recognize these others. It doesn't make sense. Last thing, towards the bottom, now we're just three and four lines up from the end of this paragraph. Hatred against mankind. Why would the Christians get that charge? Just picturing yourself as an outsider, knowing very little about this religion, why would they have the reputation of haters of humanity? hatred of mankind. Any wild guesses? Yeah. Oh, hand or no hand?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, hand.
To be, like, not of this world sort of thing, so, like, getting rid of the ways of the world and trying to do something different.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And some of the practical ways that that's going to be sort of lived out. The idea, again, of sort of not necessarily participating in the secular order, not wanting to pay taxes, not necessarily wanting to serve in the military or other public offices, but then other things as well. Idolatry, from the Christian perspective, would be mixed in with a lot of Roman practices, such as going shopping in the marketplace, where there is meat that has been, you know, you can guess, sacrificed to idols, sacrificed to the Roman gods, and then it ends up in the marketplace. So Christians don't want to go there. They don't want to go to the games. They don't want to go to the circuses because, again, it's a festival to a pagan deity, but also there's a bunch of violence, and a lot of Christians are already not holding with that. They don't want to turn out for festivals. They don't want to do anything. And the Romans just see this as antisocial behavior. Those fuddy-duddy Christians, they just want to hang out with one another. They don't want to come play with us. So they have, you know, abominations, mischievous superstition, hatred against mankind. It's not going well. But the question is, again, sort of, okay, this is why everybody was basically okay with Nero scapegoating the Christians for the Great Fire of Rome and doing horrible things like, you know, turning them loose, covered in the skins of beasts so they're torn apart by dogs, nailing them to crosses because that's still quite fashionable, or just dipping them in oil and burning them alive. You know, everybody just kind of is okay with this. So the question is that the New World Order? Is that, you know, sort of how things are, how things have been for Christians up to this point, and how things are ever going to be until Constantine comes and saves us all? A couple hundred years later. In order to ask that question, or have a look at an answer to that question, what that might look like, we'll move to a text that's actually composed around the same time as Tacitus's writing, but 50 years or so after the Great Fire of Rome and what Nero did. I've got an excerpt from a letter by Pliny the Younger to Trajan. Trajan was an emperor. Pliny was just below him. He was, at this point, at the point of writing, he was the governor of Pontus Bithynia. And we've got lots of his letters. It's sort of everything from administrative stuff, boring stuff, to what do you want for your birthday? literally, I'm not making that up. But just to have a look, Pliny, when he becomes governor, notices this sort of antisocial tendency of some of the Christians in his province. Pontus Bithynia is, we call it Turkey now, Asia Minor. So that's where he is. And he's noticing that the Christians aren't turning out to the marketplaces. They're not turning out to these other social activities. So there's this sort of unrest that he thinks he might should check. But before he does that, he writes to his emperor. If somebody could read, just go ahead, both of those paragraphs, nice and loud.
It is my practice, my lord, to refer you to you all matters concerning which I am in doubt. For who can better give guidance to my hesitation or inform my ignorance? I have never participated in trials of Christians. I therefore do not know what offenses it is the practice to punish or investigate, and to what extent. And I have been not a little hesitant as to whether there should be any distinction on account of age, or no difference between the very young and the more mature, whether pardon is to be granted for repentance, or, if a man has once been a Christian, it does him no good to have ceased to be one, whether the name itself, even without offenses, or only the offenses associated with the name are to be punished. Meanwhile, in the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I have observed the following procedure. I interrogated these as to whether they were Christians, Those who confessed I interrogated a second and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted I ordered executed. For I had no doubt that, whatever the nature of their creed, stubbornness and inflexible obstinacy surely deserved to be punished. There were others possessed of the same folly, but because they were Roman citizens, I signed an order for them to be transferred to Rome.
Does that last line sound familiar? It's what happened to Paul.
Katie?
Yes.
One of the backgrounds to this letter, as I understand it, is there was a decree from Trajan. They were having problems with groups meeting.
Yes.
You know, like Kiwanis and
right, right.
And so there was a decree that went out that asked groups not to meet. And
yes.
one of the reasons that Pliny is somewhat suspect here, and he's suspect of Christians, is that here they are gathering together and meeting. And
yes.
It's against the...
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. In fact, I mean, I've just given you a short bit of it. But in the very next paragraph, he goes on to say, I mean, this is their defense, that, you know, they're only doing these innocent things. And he lists sort of the practices as they've been explained to him. And moreover, he says, you know, they assure me that ever since I made that decree in accordance with your own of disbanding political associations, that they haven't been doing this, they haven't been meeting. So yeah, that absolutely is in the background. And that is something that's going to be making the Christians sort of suspect. Are they or are they not insisting on gathering? So if you look at, this is Epistle 10, for anybody who wants to look up the rest, you will get exactly references to that background detail as well. But one of the really interesting things is right at the outset, Pliny admits that he has never participated in the trials of Christians. And this is a guy that, you know, he didn't just sort of make a big donation to Trajan's favorite political organization and then get appointed. You know, he sort of followed what's called the cursus honorum, the sort of the course of offices and duties. So he started low and worked his way up the corporate ladder. And he's never actually encountered this problem before, which is pretty good evidence, as evidence goes, that the Christians might have been sporadically persecuted, but there was nothing sort of top-down order from the emperor, you know, if you find this sort of thing, you know, you should hunt it out, root it out, and execute everybody involved, no questions asked. In fact, you can look, we're going to disband here because 545 is upon us and dinner calls. But if you look at the answer that Trajan writes to Pliny, he admits too, yeah, no, it's not possible to lay down any general rule, and these Christians, while troublesome, are not to be sought out. If they're denounced and proved guilty, okay, punished without reservation. But towards the end, he even says, you know, we're not going to deal with looking for them, you know, hunting them down. And we're not going to deal with anonymous accusations. If somebody just slips a note under your door that says Steve's a Christian, we're not going to just find Steve and follow that to its logical conclusion, because this isn't in keeping with the spirit of our age. So the Romans maintain this sort of pragmatic toleration. They're not seeking out the Christians unless their lack of piety, their lack of pietas, is really being disruptive. I think what we'll start with on Thursday, right before we get to sort of Christian responses to the treatment they are getting, is some things that will look a little bit more familiar, because there are some late top-down, empire-wide persecutions that get sort of famous and really come to characterize how Christians view this period in the church's history. They're just blown into a slightly more proportion than they had, which is easy to do when most of your friends and family are being rounded up and driven into the Colosseum. But just to conclude, what we've seen is that the violence against the Christians in these generations wasn't systematic, it wasn't necessarily constant, but it was there, and those, you know, sort of pogroms against the Christians do leave a particular aftertaste. And so for the most part, The Christians to whom these scriptures and martyrdom accounts that we're going to look at on Thursday are written and are speaking were less hunted and trembling in the catacombs. That's sort of a mythic image of what the Christians are doing. They're more just socially awkward people, which makes a sort of sense. I mean, when I was in high school, and as we still are, yeah, no, I mean, 1 Peter 4 really spoke to me when I was in high school and didn't feel like I had a lot of friends and sort of took refuge in, well, it's because I'm a Christian and I was told I would be persecuted. Actually, I was just socially awkward. And part of that was, in fact, tied into my faith, but nobody was hunting me down. So it's interesting the way these things do speak to us. But nevertheless, martyrdom accounts, and certainly the New Testament scriptures, do become bestsellers. And what we're going to look at on Thursday is how these things were, what they were saying, first of all, and how they were speaking to Christians in these generations. So anyway, thank you for your attention. I've used all our time, but if anybody has any questions, I'll be wandering over to the dining hall and happy to talk with you further. But thanks.
Can we check?